The anti-commons is a resource where there are any number of people who can veto the right of someone to use that resource. And if there are any number of people who can veto the right of somebody to use the resource, that destroys the incentives for developing the resource in the context of patents. Where there are many overlapping patent protections, that makes it hard for any innovator to find his way through in this context of overlapping patents. And Milton Friedman even framed this debate 45 years ago in a very important paper that set up the obvious monopoly problems that would be created in the context of this intangible patent protection, especially extending that in the context of software was an obvious extension to this. Now, this skepticism should have led policymakers to be more concerned about software patents and whether software patents were doing more good than harm before they launched this massive experiment in regulating innovation in this particular field. Experiment, because there had been lots of innovation in software before patents came along. So here was an intervention by the regulators in a field that had already displayed extraordinary innovation. And the claim was this intervention was designed to increase the innovation. But we've had no evidence so far that this intervention has done any good. And I would say 2 years ago, the most someone could say is that we have no evidence that it's done any good. But now here's the fifth obvious point, which is becoming increasingly strong. In my view, we're getting some more evidence recently, new evidence, that is increasingly demonstrating that software patents are actually doing harm to the innovation process in software. Of course, people who'd lived in software predicted they would do harm, but now the economists are increasingly able to demonstrate that they are doing harm. And a paper which is, I guess it's not yet released, right?
I think it's on the way.
So Besson and Hunt have this extraordinarily interesting study now which pulls together a number of points. Let me just highlight three that are most salient. They've observed that increasing patent behavior by innovating companies actually results in decreasing R&D spending for those companies. What's happening is companies are substituting patents for research and development. So patents become a cheaper way to get ahead than actually doing research and development, and therefore the hypothesis that said that patents would induce more innovation is contradicted by the evidence. There's a myth, especially in the United States, that what patents do is they enable the small inventor to protect himself against the massive company out there. But actually what we're seeing is that patents are the behavior of gathering patents is something that large companies are engaging in. Small companies are not in the process of using this for any pro-innovation purpose. And most fundamentally is there's increasing evidence that we have no good reason to think that these are actually inducing more incentives to innovate. That economic conclusion is buttressed by many ad hoc interventions that last couple years. Mark Lemley, one of the major legal scholars studying patents in the United States right now, quoting a venture capitalist in the Valley saying, none of my companies seek patent protection because they actually think it will protect them from competition. Rather, they seek patents to protect themselves from other people who have patents. This is an arms race, so therefore there's lots of money spent in that arms race, but it's not an arms race that's actually producing any positive social good. Stephen Levy, when interviewing Jeff Bezos of Amazon, asking about the one-click patent, a particularly egregious form of software patents, the business method patent, asked if they would have developed the one-click even if there were no patent system to protect it and if anyone could legally rip it off. Bezos, without even hesitating, said, yes, very definitely, they would have developed the one-click patent without any, the one-click invention without any patent protection at all. The best evidence, in my view, now is that we should be relatively confident that the costs of this system of regulation in the context of software are greater than any increased incentives to innovate, which is the benefit that the system is supposed to produce, and this should matter to the rational regulator, because the rational regulator should be asking the question, which form of regulation in this context is going to actually produce some positive incentives. Now, even though there's no good policy-based reason for pushing software patents, we still have an extraordinary number of people pushing it. And the question is, why? Now, there's a lot of cultural things we could talk about. I don't mean, you know, Europe versus the United States. I mean lawyers versus people, right? So lawyers have the very proud of their form of reasoning and believe that their form of reasoning is shouldn't be questioned by mere mortal things like economics or causation. Those types of inquiries are inappropriate in lawyer thinking. So lawyers believe that they have some insight into truth that's independent from reality, and it's that kind of mentality that pushes this expansion without opening itself up to any rational policy criticism. So that is one, not really pathological reason, but it's one reason that we might see this expansion. But I think that we can see the business interest reason in this expansion, and understand that it's been long understood. So my favorite quote in this debate is a quote that comes from Mr. Bill Gates in 1991, long before he was a predatory monopolist in any sense of the word. Gates said of patents, "If people had understood how patents would be granted when most of today's ideas were invented and had taken out patents, the industry, the software industry," he said, "would be at a complete standstill today." So the claim was software would not have developed the innovations that it developed if, in fact, there had been patents when the innovations were going on. He then continues, shifts from insightful policy wonk to genius businessman. He says in the rest of this memo, "The solution is patenting as much as we can. A future startup with no patents of its own will be forced to pay whatever price the giants choose to impose. That price might be high. Established companies have an interest in excluding future competitors." Established companies have an interest in excluding future competitors. The function of patents in this insightful business person's mind would be a tool for excluding competitors and weakening the competitive process here. So there's an obvious strategic benefit for some companies in facilitating this expansion in patents, for some, but no general economic benefit has been proven, or I think could be proven, for all. So what is really pushing this? I think it's important to put this particular debate about software patents into a more general policy debate that's going on around the world right now. In my view, we're in the middle of an type of extremism in thoughts about what's called intellectual property. Extremism in the sense that we have lost a traditional understanding of the appropriateness of balance in the context of intellectual property. Not balance because of lefty liberal reasons, although, of course, lefty liberals would like balance here too, but balance for pure economic innovative reasons. Balance in intellectual property is essential to create an environment where maximum innovation and creativity can occur. Extremism, either extremism on the pro-IP side or extremism on the non-IP side, weakens the environment for innovation. But we're in the middle of this battle about extremism, increasingly pushed by the United States. And unfortunately, not sufficiently resisted by the only party out there who would have the credibility to resist it, the EU. Now, the benefit to established companies from this extremism is obvious. The harm to new competitors is increasingly obvious. And more importantly, you might think, the benefit to the rich countries around the world is obvious, increasingly without regard to how this extremism is affecting poor countries around the world. We had the Doha Accord, which set up certain policies to enable developing nations to take part in an intellectual property system around the world in a more balanced and fair way. The United States has, in my view, increasingly corrupted that process, using the trade office to force developing nations to sign on to more restrictive trade agreements through bilateral negotiations than the Doha Accord would have required. That's a practice that has at its focus advancing the interests of the United States against the interests of the developing nation from the perspective of what Doha originally suggested. And most troublingly, for people like me who support patents, and especially support drug patents, is the extremism in the context of Africa. We're in a world where 15 to 30 million people are dying from the AIDS virus. The United States has played a role to slow the deployment of technology into these regions that would spread drugs to these 15 to 30 million people who are dying in the name of the ideals of intellectual property. Now, I don't recognize those ideals the way the United States has increasingly pushed them. I see the ideals of intellectual property as a much more balanced, pragmatic set of protections that differ substantially based on the country and the particular development of the country. And it's that focus on balance that intellectual property debate has got to increasingly get back to. This extreme ideology harms the proper development of property protections in the context of this debate. And that extreme ideology, I think, in someday, I can hope, right, in 20 years, let's hope, we'll look back to this time and just wonder what it was that allowed us to embrace such extremism when the cost of the extremism is so obvious, especially to developing nations around the world. 20 years from now, our kids will look at us and say, how could you, in the name of an ideal as abstract as patents, resisted the deployment of these technologies in places where there are 15 to 30 million people dying? Now, that extremism is what needs to be resisted. The rational regulator has got to increasingly demand of those who ask for regulation the regulatory impact statement that shows that the benefits from a particular form of regulation outweigh the costs. The rational regulator should demand that of those who demand patent protection for software. If that question were asked of those who demand software patents in Europe, there is not support sufficiently strong to outweigh, in my view, the fairly clear evidence of the strategic costs and burdens that this system imposes on innovation across the software industry. This is an extremism which only certain people can credibly resist. I think Europe is in the position, if it were to do it, credibly to resist this form of extremism. And I only have the pleasure of being in Europe for 4 hours on this trip, but I came here just for 4 hours to say that it's important in the United States to have credible voices who question not the notion that ideas and creativity need some form of protection. It's important not to have anarchy offered as the alternative, but increasingly to have people who focus on what has been a common tradition about intellectual property protection, the tradition that says the balance here is focused on evidence that there is an economic gain from this form of regulation, at least certainly in the context of patents. So I'm gonna stop.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell me what you really think? It's a very interesting talk. There are parts I agree with, parts I don't agree with, but we could talk about that later. Good morning. It's good to see you all. First, tell me a little bit about who's here, okay? How many of you are software engineers? Okay. How many people here are in small businesses? Okay. How many are government people? We like you anyway. That's all right. That's all right. All right. All right. It gives me some perspective. You know, your debate about whether to allow patents for software or not raises significant public policy questions about the role of innovation in your society. And although many of you would like me to give you some opinion about whether it's good or bad, I think it really would be presumptuous of me to do so. I think this is something you have to look at yourself and look at what other examples are out there and what experiences are occurring right now. And I hope that today, by discussing a little bit about some of the information that we've gathered in the United States, I can offer some insights and perhaps confirm or dispel some of the notions you already have in looking at this question. Now, the first thing I should tell you is my lawyer requires that I tell you that my comments are my own and not necessarily those of the other commissioners. And I can change my mind, too, but for now, I can give you some of my views of what we've learned so far. Would it help if I began by telling you just for a second about the FTC and why we're involved in this discussion at all? Who we are, what we do? Is it too early in the morning? Yes? No? Okay. We're a small little agency of about 1,000 people that we have lawyers and economists, both, so that we have people who can assume a perfect world and then other people who can tell you why it doesn't exist. So they both are on our staff. And what we do is we have a two-part mission. We are the competition agency. We share that jurisdiction with the Department of Justice. But we also are the U.S. government's consumer protection agency. And it's two sides of the same coin. On one side, we believe through full and fair competition, consumers get the best goods and services at the lowest prices. And through good consumer protection, consumers feel confident to invest in the marketplace. Now, we've gotten involved in looking at intellectual property issues in a number of different ways. There are a lot of people who've talked about our agency as being probably at the forefront of really looking at technology, looking at not only just tech issues, but also in competition, but also biotech and a few other areas that are rapidly changing industries. And to look at the impact of competition law in those areas. And through the years, most recently, that we've looked at the question of innovation and whether there exists an innovation marketplace and whether competition law can help to ensure that the marketplace for ideas continue to thrive. Now, there's been a long-running debate in America for a number of years between intellectual property advocates who believe that that protecting the rights of individuals through patents and copyrights is a civil rights issue and should be unquestioned. At the same time, there are competition purists who believe that the grant of an intellectual property right is nothing more than a monopoly. But the real world may lie actually somewhere in between. That's part of the balance that I think you talked about, Larry. And what we decided to do is to try to create a forum which both sides could actually begin to talk about in a less confrontational way what we see is going on out there. So we decided to use one of our tools, which is a public hearing. And we had a series of public hearings because we recognized how important intellectual property has become to a variety of industries and to our overall economy. And I think that we wanted to just get information that will guide us as policymakers on how we should consider intellectual property issues and the role of competition. So the goals were threefold. One is to get a frank and candid discussion about where intellectual property rights and competition policy intersect. Second, to get a clearer understanding of what are the policy goals behind each discipline. And third, to really begin to examine what the future might look like based on what is occurring in several key industries. Now, you've already heard that we are going to issue a report sometime, I guess, within the next 6 months. So since it hasn't been issued yet, I can't give you what our conclusions are because we haven't decided what our conclusions will be yet. But I can give you some observations about what we've been hearing. And as Brian mentioned, you can also visit our website, ftc.gov, and it has a lot of the papers that people have submitted that give you an idea of the range of comments that we're getting. Now, and although the official comment period has closed, we are still taking suggestions and submissions. So if you have a viewpoint, you can feel free to express it. Now, our hearings took place between February and November 2002. We held over 30 sessions, including 3 days of roundtable discussions. We've received over 50 submissions. We've heard from over 200 speakers, including businessmen, economists, academics, patent attorneys, judges, antitrust lawyers, and industry groups. And I think that Brian was among them, and some other people who are here, who you'll be hearing from over the next couple of days. And we focused on a variety of issues, including patent pooling, cross-licensing, strategic licensing, patent standards and quality, standard-setting practices and patent settlements, international comparisons, the role of the Federal Circuit, which is a court that's specifically designed to hear patent cases, and specifically focusing on what is occurring in three sectors. Computer hardware and semiconductors. Second is biotechnology. And third is what's happening in the pharmaceutical industry. But we also spent some time talking specifically about software and internet patents. Now, we're doing this together with the Department of Justice, who also has competition authority, but also a participant in this was the Patent and Trademark Office in the United States. And I thought it was significant because this gives us an opportunity to do something that, as Professor Lessig talks about, lawyers don't do or not necessarily trained to do, and for that matter, most government people aren't trained to do either, which is actually looking forward to think about the future. And competition policy is probably the few areas where we actually have some statutory mandate to actually consider what the future might look like. Now, let me share some broader themes raised at the hearing, and then I'll focus on two software issues. One key policy question is, what's the right amount of protection to afford an innovator? And included in that is, how do we incentivize innovation? The second is, what specifically should be patentable and other patent quality issues? And finally, what is the relationship between competition enforcement and intellectual property? Now, let me focus specifically on software patents. The information we received at these hearings, as you can guess, was pretty wide-ranging. And our goal was to be a neutral party, just be a fact gatherer. But the comments seem to focus on two principal areas. First, is an investment issue that whether software firms, namely small software firms, need to be able to point to some intellectual property in order to raise venture capital. The second issue that people seem to focus on was a broader issue, was what is the role of innovation generally within the software industry. Now, on the first point, it goes without saying, especially nowadays, that the ability of small firms to raise venture capital is an important factor it's an important factor in any industry because we think the ability to enter actually challenges existing incumbent businesses to provide better products and services. And new entry can also bring new ideas. Now, there were some people who focused on the fact that some firms depend on patents to raise capital in the startup phase. And we heard that some venture capitalists do look for that. So some startups may actually fashion their business model primarily around some intellectual property that they have. And some economists actually talked about, for smaller firms, that they're viewed as being players in the industry if they have some sort of patent. But we found that that's not as important in some parts of the industry rather than the others. Like, these larger firms, believe it or not, in some industries like the semiconductor industry, although they have a lot of patents and that they're involved in that business, it's not the same kind of affirmative use of patent rights as you see in the biotechnology industry, where people try to block other people out. In many cases, this was used as a defensive measure to try to prevent others from claiming rights to their existing innovation. Now, one observer noted that if the idea is to reward innovators with a patent, then we should really calibrate the degree of reward to the type of contribution it actually makes. In other words, if patent policy was a means toward getting funding, then we shouldn't worry about patentability standards. However, some people thought, and it was a fairly significant group of people, that patents were not really necessary to raise capital at all, and it's not really a preferable business model for software firms. And in fact, that the current trend in venture capital is really looking to whether the startup can achieve some sort of commercial success, not just whether it has some intellectual property right. In other words, it's how it uses its ideas. So, and that there are many people in the software industry that thought that it was more important for the company to be in the marketplace quicker rather than whether it spent all its energy gaining patent rights. Okay? And in fact, there were some pretty significant players that believed that it was actually wasteful for small software firms to spend valuable engineers' time worrying about patents. They should worry about productivity. Now, that gives you the range of comments that we have. And the second issue that we really dealt with in the software industry was, what is innovation? One important message that came out in our hearings was that competition and intellectual property protection play different roles in different industries, as I talked about a little earlier. In pharmaceuticals, you may have a more offensive use in software may be a more defensive use. So the role of competition was actually seen as more important, and the role of patent protection was seen as less important within the software industry than in pharmaceutical and biotech. Through the hearings, we've learned that that's because of some very significant difference within the software sector. The market moves faster, and there's that more dynamic change. More of the innovation was incremental, that there were diverse types and sizes of firms within the software industry, that also innovators within software don't routinely publish their innovations. And finally, small firm entry is actually easier within the software industry. So these market conditions, those factors that I just outlined, raise in part the question of whether patents have actually benefited software innovation in the United States. Now, one software entrepreneur on this point specifically testified that patents don't incentivize innovation. He said, software patents actually tangibly have no value. They don't increase the rate of innovation in our industry at all. All they've done is impose this huge cost on our industry and have not done anything for accelerating innovation because guys like me, all the entrepreneurs out there, are going to launch our companies anyway. Now, let me conclude by mentioning a couple of things. I have a general observation that this policy discussion goes back to that grand question of whether patents are good or bad. Our report's not going to give easy answers to that because it's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all question. What we've seen is the use of patents within various industries result in different kinds of consequences. And I think you have an opportunity to explore that a little bit here. And I expect to learn something from you as well. So I'm here to answer any questions that you might have. So I'm not quite where Larry is, but I do ask a series of questions that you might want to ask to begin to determine where that balance actually lies. And one of the opportunities that you have here in Europe, and I think that we have to go back and sort of catch up with in the United States, is being able to take it. One of the problems that you have when you deal with how our patent system works, and partly how lawyers are trained, they're trained to deal with snapshots of events that have already happened or prior art. They're not necessarily looking toward what's going to happen next. And one of the big surprises to me in talking to intellectual property advocates as well as competition lawyers is that there was an agreement that competition law actually has some place, some role in perhaps how we look at the problem of patents, where we achieve the balance, and also being able to chop back what I consider sometimes to be, for example, overbroad action or perhaps an unfounded or inappropriate view of the scale of intellectual property right. So it's very interesting. As I said, I'll be here to answer your questions.
I just spoke with Hartmut, and we're going to run over this session a little bit because one of the speakers for the next session has not shown up. So I'm going to first ask Larry if he wants to take an opportunity to say anything, and then we'll have some questions.
I'd be eager for questions.
Okay. Let me make one comment, and that is this one-size-fits-all issue. I was at the European Policy for Intellectual Property Conference 2 weeks ago, and this came up over and over again. And this plays into the economists versus lawyers issue because, as some of you may know, the TRIPS, which is incorporated into the World Trade Organization Charter, basically says one size fits all for technologies. Now, the U.S. government has taken a position beyond that in the negotiations for a substantive patent law treaty, and has argued that the rest of the world should embrace the American standard on subject matter, which is to say no standard at all, that all activities, technological or not, should be eligible for patenting. And of course, the implication there is that one size fits all pertains to everything and not just technology. Certainly from the economist's point of view, this is a very difficult standard to work with because it's basically hostile to any empirical research which might demonstrate otherwise, that patents in fact do have a different impact on different industries or are used differently within different industries. So there's a fundamental problem there that we appear to be locked into, and this was of course something that was locked into back in the very early 90s before the internet had come along and we were operating in a very different world. So with that comment, let me throw...
Well, let me respond to it a little bit, though. I think the competition committee at section in the European Commission is beginning to look at some of these questions as well. Let me give you some real-life examples. We're sitting there, we're bringing actual competition cases in this area, challenging certain kinds of activities which we think are an abuse of intellectual property rights. So, for example, we've had some very well-publicized cases against pharmaceutical companies who they have an offensive use of patents to block other people out, to block out the creation of generic drugs, for example, that will compete with them. And sometimes the way they do that is unlawful, by claiming prior art when there isn't any prior art, or by listing, engaging in listings with the Food and Drug Administration when they know that their patent actually does not cover the new drug that's coming in. So we've seen that happen. That's a very distinct use of intellectual property in what we think is an inappropriate way. At the same time, that in the computer industry and in the software industry, we're seeing in software and hardware industries, it's a bit of a different use. And in fact, when sometimes companies try to assert an intellectual property right, there is a strong backlash against them. We have a very, I can't say much about it except that it's a very well-publicized case right now that's currently in litigation against a major memory chip manufacturer who was part of a standard-setting organization, and the allegation was that they participated in this organization for years to try to steer the standard for chip memory chips in a certain direction. And once that direction was established, then they disclosed the fact that they had two controlling patents in the area and were going to charge a license to everybody who wanted to build chipsets. We had a problem with that. But that is more unusual in the... that we found that more unusual in that industry. But what you also see, though, is the ability to use different kinds of vehicles, whether it's patent pooling. For example, a few companies decide they're going to pool their patents on certain kinds of innovation to prevent other innovation from getting to the marketplace. And so we see that in a variety of different areas. It's a very interesting problem, and... that's why I said when trying to achieve that kind of balance, part of it is understanding how a particular industry might use or abuse intellectual property rights.
Doesn't a lot of this go to the question of complex versus simple or discrete technologies, that in complex technologies you really need the patent pools to enable products to be produced because of the proliferation of patents?
Yes and no. Yes, to some extent, but we also have issued guidelines out there of when what we call joint ventures might actually be unlawful. So I think in some ways, as I said, some of the folks who are involved in intellectual property, yes, Larry, even lawyers, are actually happy that we, as a competition agency, are looking very closely at this, because sometimes there are abuses within the system that there has to be some alternative other than going through a multi-million dollar patent challenge, which may, for most small businesses, is unthinkable.
We have time for a couple of questions. Yes.
I would like to see if, by any chance, Professor Lessig was asked by Europe or United States to redo completely from scratch all what is related to patent and software. How do you think you could make this balance between the economical advantage for the people who are creating something and the intellectual property and something which could practically work?
Well, I don't know enough to know what the ideal system is, so nobody does. But what I was trying to suggest is a method. And the method was to start with minimal regulation and add regulation only when there was pretty good evidence it was doing more good than harm. So that method in this context would say software already has intellectual property protection through copyright, through trade secrets. Is there any good reason to believe it needs something more in order to produce the type of innovation that we want in the context of software? I just don't think that case has been made. Now, some people have suggested, Microsoft has suggested, that it would be better if we had something like patent protection in software. It's better than copyright, it's better than trade secrets. So we should try to craft a different system that's like patent protection, but not the existing patent system. And that could actually be better because it would induce more software reuse, where you get a much more componentized system if it were actually done well. And so in my view, that's a theoretically possible, possibly better system. But even though I'm an academic, I don't like to think about these things theoretically like that. What I really think regulators should do is demand the evidence before they add new kinds of regulation. And I think if that simple framing question were asked in this context, there wouldn't be the evidence to support additional regulation.
You know, where I might disagree with you, Larry, is this, is that when you talk about regulatory structure and the patent office embarking on software patents, I think you give it too much credit, in the sense that as if they were at the time really thinking about it seriously enough to think that what we need to do is regulate this industry. I actually don't think that they were thinking that deeply about it to actually get to that stage. And maybe that says something in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. That they were not thinking carefully about it. I think that's the problem. But they clearly changed their rules. Mm-hmm. And changing their rules without thinking carefully about whether there's a good reason to extend patents here is the problem I was complaining of, that I think Europe shouldn't commit the same error.
Well, at least they have the opportunity to see a broader picture and to have a lot more evidence when they consider the question.
An interesting comparison is, as far as I know, the mission statement of the U.S. Patent Office is still to help customers get patents, whereas the European Patent Office, and I just learned this 2 weeks ago, has reformulated its mission in terms of economic outcomes. Mm-hmm. Very significant difference. Hartman, do we have time for one more comment?
We're still waiting for Ms. Kopke to come, but I think she's coming in a few minutes.
Okay. Yes.
Actually, I've got two very brief questions, I hope. First of all, one of the big problems in license pools, such as that for MPEG, for example, is that of the pure licensee. I'm thinking here of universities. I'm thinking here of contingency lawyers. I'm thinking here of innumerable methods where they have no real interest in product. These are companies that just own patents for the purpose of exploiting those as best they can. And the license pools, and Baron Futra, for example, at MPEG-LA will freely admit he cannot handle that situation, and there seems no way forward. I'd like a comment on that. The other is you comment on the small businesses and the need for venture capital. Now, in a situation where it's going to cost me a minimum of $500,000 to defend a patent, I can see I might have a need for venture capital. But the days of Kernighan and Ritchie, the days of Frank Hewlett and Packard and so on, seem to have disappeared. Bill Gates in his garage. Whatever happened to that in the States? And is there any hope that it might return?
Yes. Well, let's deal with a couple of first question first. That, and you can jump in. And this is where I might have a slightly different spin on the idea of intellectual property with you, Larry, is this. First of all, the idea of intellectual property rights contained in our Constitution, right? So that means it's there. But to take lawyers out of it is virtually impossible, because the grant of the intellectual property right is an entirely legal fiction. So it's impossible to divorce them entirely. The question is whether in looking at how we wind up, and it's the government who confers the benefit, whether we are asking the right questions and thinking about the marketplace in looking at the grant of an intellectual property right. Okay. So now, second, I still think that there are still so many incentives to get rich in the United States that I'm not worried that the ability of garage innovators those days are over. The question is, I think it's twofold. One is sort of a return to reality, is that now is the market adequately valuing real ideas that have real marketability? That's one. And then second of all, is the marketplace open enough so that there are not corruptions within that marketplace to create artificial barriers to entry, including looking at the role of dominant players and whether they're actually acting in a predatory fashion. So in other words, as a competition agency, I'm not worried about going out of business anytime soon either. Okay, but I think that if we do our job right, that still should be out there.
Well, the Constitution actually says nothing about intellectual property. It says nothing about Congress's duty to grant intellectual property. The Constitution says Congress has the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts. And so it has, as you rightly point out, an understanding that Congress will be granting these, as they understood them, monopolies. But it goes on to say that these monopolies are going to be granted for a particular purpose, to promote progress. That's a classically economic way of thinking about what this is about, and under very strict limits. Limited times is the most important of those. So I think even from the start, it wasn't lawyers who thought this is ideology 101 and therefore we have to have property. It was a bunch of practical people who said, if you're going to hand out government-backed monopolies, you need a very good reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And that should only be for promoting progress, not to enable the kinds of anti-competitive activity that your commission fights all the time.
I'd like to comment on your question, because it raises a very tough issue about trying to make innovation more of a competitive marketplace. And the vision that many scholars have had is that patents could, in fact, create vigorous markets for new ideas. The downside of that is it also
creates opportunities for differentiated models of exploiting patents, including the licensing firms that you spoke about. And what we see in the boom and bust cycle is a lot of use of patents to support business plans as part of the upside. And then when the market collapses, a lot of exploitation of patents as the last assets of going businesses and the migration of many of these patents into licensing firms that are the downside. So possibly patents create an overinvestment effect on the upside and then actually discourage investment more because of the threat of holdup on the downside.
In the back.
Okay, one more, and then regardless of whether the moderator is here, we should get the next panel going. Yes.
My question is rather simple. How can small businesses benefit from software patents? Because it's just very simple. I've been involved in a project directly where I've been stuck with software patents because of a company doing business in the United States. And if we would really all of the software I would be writing really go through all of the patents that can be applicable to the project I'm working on, I would need to maybe double the size of the company to get a complete legal team in position to filter through all the code and all of the different patents. And as a last remark, the problem with software patents and what we're seeing in the United States is what is patentable. And the problem is if even somebody in Germany a couple of years ago tried to patent it if then else in a programming sequence and the court, thank God, turned it down, I'm really having serious doubts how the medium and small-sized businesses can benefit from software patents. It's just a block of concrete on our leg because of all of the legal costs involved. Not as a last thing to mention, how much trouble there is involved of keeping track how many software patents are being handed out by the EPO. And then the last thing, how really valid are some of those software patents that are being out? Because every minor little change is patentable, and I've seen enough of those examples on slash.org on what is patentable. Thank you.
Yeah, another part of what I do is work in this organization called Creative Commons. And Creative Commons has a licensing system to enable people to mark their content in a machine-readable way to say it's free for the following types of uses. When we launched this project, I asked our attorneys to review whether we'd be infringing any software patents. And the first thing the attorney said was, no, we won't do that review for you. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, if we look and we discover that there are software patents that you're infringing, then you're in real trouble. So I said, well, that's very interesting, but I really want to know whether we are infringing any software patents. So he said, okay, fine, we will do a search. We will discover between 50 and 100 patents that are possibly relevant to your simple technology. It will cost between $5,000 and $10,000 per patent for us to evaluate whether that patent, in fact, reads on your technology. So if you're willing to write a check anywhere between $250,000 and $1 million to discover whether your technology is violating somebody else's property rights, we're willing to do that research for you. But we advise you not to do it. Now, it's examples like that which just so plainly speak to how this system is not serving a function of either making it clear what people's property rights are, enabling property rights to be enforced, or enabling small businesses to actually use this system, that I would think it's just, again, a very simple, obvious point that you've got to have a very compelling showing that this is going to produce lots of strong innovation to overcome what seems to be the obvious burdens that it imposes on small companies in particular.
I guess I would say that there is that practical, it's a practical problem, but my observation from the software industry is that patents are used as a defensive measure, and so one of the things you have to do is especially take a look at the industry and your subset of the industry to look at what the history is in that area, whether you think that people are likely to assert some sort of intellectual property right against you should you move forward with your idea. I think that the key is in what I've seen in small software businesses is that they're more concerned about getting their ideas out there now and to show that they have a marketable business plan. One of the interesting observations in Larry's correct that the idea of hiring all of these engineers and lawyers to essentially research every possible claim that can be made against you before you even get out there is a pretty frightening thought. But on the other hand, I think one comfort that you can take is that it's a frightening thought to everybody, so no one's willing to pull the trigger yet. In other words, that the patents are sort of like the bullets and no one's actually willing to fire.
I would just observe, in New Jersey, in the United States, small businesses pay protection money to the mafia. They only do it for defensive purposes, to defend themselves against violence. But I wouldn't say that's a good recommendation for Europe to do the same thing in local businesses that they have.
Thank you very much. The next panel is ready to go.
Right. So I'm going to have to leave this panel at 11 o'clock.
That's okay.
Okay.
Ms. Colby also has to leave.
Okay. Hi.